Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how advocates plan to bring up the state's reading proficiency rates among Arizona students.
And how our state can balance agriculture and urban water needs in the future.
But first, it wasn't so long ago that Arizona's largest utility, APS, committed to get 65% of its energy from clean sources like solar and wind power by the year 2030. By 2050, they said the energy that powers much of the valley would be 100% clean. But now they're getting rid of those goals. The company announced the move last week, saying they have to do it to keep up with mounting demand for power in our fast-growing metropolis. It comes on the heels of another big announcement from all of the state's utilities that they're investing in a major new pipeline to deliver natural gas from West Texas all the way here to the Sonoran Desert. And our first guest this morning reports that it's raising questions about political influence and if the company is taking advantage of a time when the Trump administration is rolling back a whole lot of environmental protections. Wayne Shutsky has the story for our politics desk, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning there, Wayne.
Good morning.
All right. Begin for us with this new pipeline. This represents a big investment in energy that is not clean, I guess we could say.
That's right. So to remind our listeners, clean energy is anything that's not producing greenhouse gases. So natural gas, while considered cleaner than something like coal, still is producing the CO2 and the greenhouse gases.
Right.
And this investment is coming from APS, SRP, and some other utilities across the state are also working on deals to get in on it, basically to really increase the amount of gas coming into the state to meet, as you mentioned, growing demand. Our state's growing both population and a lot of energy intensive industries like data centers.
Right, right. And we're seeing so many of those being built. So this is all coming at the same time we see last week an announcement from APS that they're no longer going to hold themselves to those clean energy goals that I outlined there. What reason did they give?
So they basically said what I just said, which is that, you know, we've got, the state is using more and more energy every year. We've got lots of people coming in, lots of businesses coming in, and they consider gas to be, you know, this reliable kind of backbone. Gas makes up over 40% of the energy our state currently gets, and it's considered kind of just a reliable source. And so they say they need that reliable source to ensure, especially during the summer, that, you know, when people turn on the lights, turn on the AC, that it's going to work.
Right. And we just saw, I think it was last week or the week before, APS announcing they reached another new peak demand. We're seeing more people here, more people using, you know, air conditioning all at the same time.
That's right. They reached peak demand. They exceeded their record last week. They exceeded it a few weeks before that. They've broken records multiple times this summer, which is basically an annual thing at this point. As temperatures continue to rise, it's hotter and more people are coming in using the AC, data centers, like I said, all that stuff.
Yeah. So APS is now saying we're not going to hold ourselves to these clean energy goals we outlined a few years ago. Are they going to hold themselves to any other kind of clean energy goals? What's the reasoning they're giving there?
Yeah, so they basically, the main reasoning that I got from them, they didn't make anyone available for an interview, but they gave me a statement, was just reliability. They say they're still going to try to reach what they call carbon neutrality by 2050, which is a little bit different than zero. Zero carbon basically means you're getting rid of all those sources that are producing the greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. Carbon neutrality means you're going to try and offset any carbon you are producing. And there's a couple different ways to do that. There's technology for carbon capture. There's investing in these so-called carbon credits, where you're investing in various different things that are supposed to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, whether it's reforestation or preserving existing forests, that kind of thing. But it's not quite the same as just not producing the CO2 to begin with.
Right. And others will say, you know, those goals, those clean energy goals they outlined a few years ago were outdated by now. Basically, like, there's just no way to make that happen given the growth we're seeing here.
Yeah, I talked to the chairman of the Corporation Commission, which is, you know, our top utility regulator in the state. It's an all Republican commission now. They're pretty in line with what APS is doing here. They have called for, you know, utilities to get rid of these goals. They say the market should control this type of thing. And again, not to beat a dead horse here, but they say, you know, they view natural gas as the most reliable backbone that's needed. They're saying, not saying that solar and wind and all those things don't have a role, but they're saying, you know, that natural gas is still needed to meet growing demand.
Okay. So let's talk about what the critics are saying here. Clean energy advocates, et cetera, environmentalists are saying this is all happening now because the political winds basically are shifting when it comes to environmental issues under the Trump administration.
That's right. President Trump has made, you know, has not made it a secret that he is not a fan of a lot of these different renewable sources. And I should just point out that clean energy also includes nuclear. So when we're saying clean, we're talking about those renewable energy sources, but we're also talking about stuff like nuclear. But specifically, the president, he doesn't like wind. He doesn't like solar fields, those type of things. At the same time, he's been promoting coal energy. So people who would like to see more renewable sources out there are saying, you know, these renewable sources are actually becoming more cost effective, more cost efficient than even natural gas, according to some analysts. So there's not really a defensible way to say, we shouldn't be investing in those. And at the same time, with improved battery technology, they're saying they're becoming more reliable because you don't have to be in a sunny day. You could, you know, you can store that energy and use it when you need it.
Yeah. APS, at the same time, we should say, Wayne, is also extending the life of its Four Corner coal plant, which they had said they were going to close a few years from now. Are they still planning to stop or move away from coal power at some point?
What they tell me now is instead of the 2031 date that they were going for is now they're going for 2038. So it still looks like they're still going to get out of it, or they're still saying they're going to get out of it, but they're pushing that down the line. Coal makes up a small fraction of, you know, it's at around 2% of the energy in Arizona. But again, it's also the dirtiest, essentially, source. So advocates say that that's just another measure to kind of, that's more about maybe political purposes than, you know, reliability of the grid.
All right. We'll leave it there. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A group of advocates has come together to start a new literacy initiative in Arizona. According to the Arizona Progress Meter, 39% of third graders in the state were rated proficient or highly proficient on one of a series of English language arts assessments last year. The goal is 72%, and last year's number is actually down 2%. With me to talk about the new Arizona Literacy Plan 2030 is Terry Clark, Arizona Literacy Director for Read On Arizona, which is behind the plan. And Terry, first off, what prompted this new initiative?
Sure. Well, we have been working for probably over 12 to 18 months over the last year and a half with education stakeholders across Arizona to get input and feedback on a shared vision for literacy, because the reality is that we're not where we need to be for our youngest learners around their literacy proficiency. And we felt like it was a really important to get shared buy-in and shared commitment to how do we improve things and work towards a strong and ambitious goal for 2030.
How did you come up with the 72% proficiency rate goal? That seems like a very specific number.
It is a specific number. It's actually aligned to the Arizona Progress Meter, which was set about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And we asked partners and stakeholders if they felt that we should look at the goal, and they felt the goal, you know, was ambitious and we needed to stay focused on it, but that we needed to outline in more detail the strategies that we need and what we need to change to get there.
So I want to talk about the strategies in just a moment, but I want to ask about sort of the feasibility of this, because we are right now right around 40% of third graders in Arizona reading at grade level. 30% more in the next 5 years seems like a pretty tall order.
It is a tall order, but only if, again, like I said, we don't look at what we're doing and do more of what works. And that's why part of the plan really spends some time talking about our scale to succeed strategies. Part of why we haven't seen the same kind of progress that other states across the country have seen is that some of what we know works, Arizona is not yet doing at scale. And until we get to scaling some of those really important interventions and supports and services so that the kids that need them the most are getting them, we shouldn't expect. We should just sort of not expect to make as much progress.
So, in your mind, what are the biggest, maybe the most important things that you all are going to be doing, even maybe some new things, maybe things that, as you reference, are being done in some schools or some districts, but really not at scale?
Sure. So we've really spent some time on those, and partners identified what we're calling scale to succeed strategies. And one of those is to basically expand the number of literacy, master literacy coaches that we have in schools that have the highest percentage of struggling readers. So, and what that does is it really puts a literacy coach on the ground, on site, that teachers who have a wide gap of readers from across the spectrum, maybe having, there's a lot of reasons why a student might be struggling with reading, but they have that coach right there so that they can have real-time feedback and support and instruction to help them improve and deliver high-quality literacy instruction to all of their students.
Are there literacy coaches out there sort of waiting to be brought into these schools?
We think so. Right, currently the Department of Education has 34 literacy coaches that are deployed. There was always a strategy that was meant to expand, and they would like the target goal for that program and is 125 or 150 literacy coaches, because that's what really serving the bottom 10% of schools with the highest percentage of students that are struggling in reading. That's what they need to be able to really help those schools make progress. So they don't have nearly where they would like to see as many coaches as possible, but we're starting somewhere, and that's at 34 coaches, and over the next 5 years, we want to see that increase.
In a perfect world, would those coaches be paid for by the State Department of Education, or would districts be paying for that?
So the way the program works now is there is a allocation in the state budget, and the Department of Education makes that funding, and that is a grant to schools and districts to be able to put that coach on site. And that, they have in the past, I understand, requested funding and not been able to get additional funding, and we hope eventually that changes.
Was there additional funding in the state budget for this year?
There was not.
So does that mean then that this can't really get going until at least next fiscal year?
Not necessarily. I think there are other possible funding sources. There are, you sometimes have to take the funding you have and just figure out how to get that to be used in a more effective way. So I think we have confidence that the department is going to be able to at least keep the 34 they have and possibly even find ways to increase and find other funding sources that would allow them to add some of those additional coaches that they want for their target goal.
Are there other things that can be done sort of within existing resources to try to help students who are struggling with their literacy and their reading?
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think this is where we see that there's no one magic solution to how do we improve early literacy. We have to think this about this more as a combination of the right supports and services. And there are lots of different partners that can play that a role in that. So you certainly have teachers doing everything they can in the classroom and schools doing everything they can and utilizing their literacy plans to be as effective as possible. And then you have community partners. And that's, I think, one of the things we're really excited about in the action commitments that have been made as part of the rollout around the Arizona Literacy Plan 2030 is community partners that may be providing professional development or high impact tutoring and other and early learning programs and services are committing to doing their part to help support our earliest learners being able to read.
Do you have a sense of where Arizona's literacy rate falls nationally or compared to other states?
Yeah, so the story that I tell is before the pandemic, we were actually had started about 10 years ago in the bottom five of all states, and then made our incremental progress, and we were almost up to the national average. And then the pandemic happened, and the rug got pulled out from everyone. And although we did rebound, we've now kind of hit a plateau and we're back down to being in the bottom third of where other states are. And I guess for me, what that tells me is that we can no longer fall back to what we were doing before the pandemic. It's no longer sufficient. We have to be more strategic and be more committed to really doing these strategies that we know work at scale and doing things differently. If we just are going to keep doing what we had been doing, we really can't expect different results. Success is possible when we're committed to doing what works and doing it at scale. And we really believe literacy has to be a priority because literacy is the key to not just a student's future, but Arizona's future.
All right. That is Terry Clark, Arizona Literacy Director for Read On Arizona. Terry, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the surprising voting habits of people who buy political merchandise.
But first, Arizona State Senator Annalise Ortiz is no stranger to political controversy. But now she is facing death threats, calls for her ouster, and more. It all comes after she posted information on her social media platforms about ICE activity in her community near a school. She says it's free speech. Her right-wing opponents say it's putting federal agents in danger. Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson asked the U.S. Attorney for Arizona for an investigation. Senator Jake Hoffman, who heads up the Freedom Caucus, called for her to be removed from office. Fox News is reporting that she could be hit with obstruction of justice charges. She sat down with me in our studios late last week to talk about it all and what she thinks it says about the state of our politics.
This all started with a reshare of a post on a community account that was letting people know there was suspected ICE activity outside of an elementary school in Levine. That terrifies me because I believe no child should be walking to school and have to fear that they will be taken or their parents will be taken. This is simply a community alert to make people aware of how the government is acting in our communities in plain sight.
So this got picked up by libs of TikTok, and all of a sudden really blew up. Talk a little bit about the reaction here. I mean, you're no stranger to controversy in politics. You're very outspoken often on issues like this, but you've got other senators calling for your ouster. We've got Fox News talking to DHS saying that, this might be obstruction of justice. What do you make of this backlash?
This is absolutely a politically motivated attack and an escalation of the far right's willingness to use the courts and investigative agencies to target their political opponents. It is another step into authoritarianism.
I wonder about the personal side of this a little bit. I mean, I know politicians are sort of used to attacks, but you're getting death threats. This is definitely, it feels more violent.
This has absolutely escalated, and it's unfortunate that my colleagues, including the Senate president, have fanned the flames of this rhetoric and these calls of incitement of violence against me personally. I'm getting all kinds of emails, people claiming they know where I live, that they're going to cause me and my family harm. This is horrible, and it's there's no place for this type of political violence in a free and fair democracy.
Have you seen this kind of thing before? I mean, I know I've spoken with other local politicians in the past and in the last just couple of years in particular, who have seen things like this happen, who have been in that position. This is, it seems, becoming more common.
It unfortunately is becoming more common. And I have taken extra precautions since the Democratic legislator Melissa Hortman was assassinated just a few short months ago. Mm-hmm. And what's ironic there is she was assassinated by someone impersonating law enforcement.
This was in Minnesota, yeah.
Yeah, and we're seeing people, wearing masks, impersonating law enforcement in order to commit crimes. So these types of public safety alerts, letting people know that there are masked men in a community outside of school is about keeping ourselves safe.
So what do you make of the criticism here, though, putting death threats aside? The claim here from the other side of this is that you are putting law enforcement in danger. We have DHS saying that they are seeing a rise in assaults against officers, that you're putting officers at risk. Do you think that's a possibility? Are you concerned about that?
I do not condone violence. I never have. I believe Arizonans deserve to know what their government is doing in their communities, and sharing public factual information of law enforcement activity is 100% protected by the First Amendment. It's no different than using the Waze app to let people know about a speed trap, or the many posts we often see on Nextdoor of drug busts going on or a police helicopter circling a neighborhood.
This is a First Amendment issue for you.
Absolutely. It is completely within my right to share information that is publicly available that anyone driving by near that elementary school could have seen with their own two eyes.
I've seen a lot of posts like this of late, of people, whether they are politicians or not, or activists or not, posting about ICE activity because we've seen so much of it. This is happening, I think, here and around the country. Is this new?
It's not new. This has been something we've seen since the days of Joe Arpaio, communities making each other aware of what the government is doing. But I think what's important to remember is that the Trump administration's tactics are new. They are lurking outside of elementary schools, targeting parents as they're dropping kids off. They are under tremendous pressure to meet these quotas where they're making mistakes. They have detained United States citizens. They have detained lawful green card holders. So people are rightfully afraid right now. And of course, the masks are new. We have men that have guns jumping out of unmarked vehicles, refusing to show badges and warrants. These are unprecedented times we are in.
Talk a little bit about what you're hearing from your community. Your district is largely parts of Maryvale, Glendale, West Phoenix. Are you hearing about a lot of fear from the community that sounds like it did 10 years ago when Arpaio was in charge?
Absolutely. And it's really unfortunate. There are people of all citizenship statuses, including United States citizens, who are afraid right now. They don't want to go drop their kids at school. They don't want to go to the grocery store or to seek health care because this administration is acting so ruthlessly and so far outside of the norm.
Talk about your role as a Democratic lawmaker. A little bit of a political question here. Is there a broader approach that your caucus is taking to these, as you call them, unprecedented times, to this mass deportation campaign? Are you thinking about this in some sort of organized political way to try to make sure that your community and their interests are protected?
Well, we are quickly seeing public sentiment shift because so many people who may have supported Trump's call to deport violent people or people who have caused serious crimes, he's not sticking to that. He is going after parents, hardworking people that are trying to make an honest living in the United States and do not have a clear pathway to citizenship because of the failures of Congress. So we are rapidly seeing people reject the authoritarianism they are seeing from Trump and from ICE. As Democrats, we are committed to informing people of their rights and protecting the Constitution, especially the right to due process, which is something that everyone should be entitled to.
I want to ask you about public sentiment and how you think it's shifting kind of against these policies. And I've seen polling to that effect as well. But I wonder this, because if we're talking about the days of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and SB 1070, we saw massive protests, people out in the streets by the thousands saying this is wrong. This is not what we want to have happen in our state and our country. We're not seeing that today. Do you think there's a reason why?
There's a lot of fear. We have seen the Trump administration crack down on free speech in a way that should chill anybody. And what happened with Mahmoud Khalil, the student who was a permanent lawful resident and was detained for over 100 days because of his political speech. They are trying to send a message to chill free speech and to keep people afraid. And that's why I find it so important to be speaking out right now, given my platform, even though I am facing death threats, even though I have had constant harassment. We can't be afraid and back down in this moment. And there are a lot of people who rightfully, you know, don't want to get involved with these protests and things of that nature because they are scared. And that's how fascism takes over.
So you are speaking out even though, you know, you're facing threats of potential prosecution. How far do you think this could go? Are you willing to keep speaking out, keep posting things like this, even if you're going to be attacked and maybe prosecuted for it?
I am confident that the First Amendment protects my right to share information about what law enforcement is doing in plain sight in our communities.
So you will continue to share this kind of information?
I believe I am on the right side of history and my speech is protected. Yes.
All right. State Senator Annalise Ortiz joining us. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Our next guest this morning gets a lot of emails like this. Stop letting people move here. Joanna Allhands is a columnist who writes about water for the Arizona Republic. And readers often write to tell her that we could easily solve our state's water woes. All we need to do is stop growing. But she is here to tell us it's not that simple. And that's why it's such a big deal that state water leaders agreed to open the door for landowners in one part of the state to sell their water to allow for more growth in places that need it, like Queen Creek and Buckeye. Joanna joins us now alongside Republic editorial page editor Elvia Diaz to talk about it all. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, Joanna, begin for us with this deal between landowners in the Harquahala Valley and places like Buckeye and Queen Creek who signed up for this water deal. How is this going to work?
This has been something that's been talked about for probably several decades now. It's always been sort of the someday idea. But now, at least in the Harquahala Basin, this is a now idea. They finally were able to get the amount of water quantified that they could transfer over 100 years. So now that process is in play. It's really a interesting way that they've kind of done this. All of the landowners in that Harquahala Basin got together and said, okay, we're basically going to master plan the way that we pump this water out of our basin.
Right.
And we're going to do this over time. We're going to transition all of this land that is currently being farmed. Mm-hmm. We're going to stop farming that and then pump that water out over time, put it in the Central Arizona Project Canal and deliver it to the cities.
Right.
It's a really new thing that's been talked about for a very long time, if that makes
right.
sense.
Right. So this is part of this broader idea that lawmakers addressed last session to it's called ag to urban, right? Like taking agricultural land, which uses a ton more water than urban cities and houses, and giving that water basically to the urban areas, stopping the farming where the water is being used.
Generally, Harquahala has been in play and has been something that's been talked about for many, many years, way before anybody was talking about ag to urban. But the concept with ag to urban is just that, where knowing that farmland uses a lot of water, taking that land out of commission, and then using that water for houses, which use a lot less, is considered to be something that might at least help us continue to grow over time without completely depleting the aquifer.
Right. So, Elvia, what do you think this kind of deal says and this idea of ag to urban says about what might be possible in terms of growth in the future of our state?
Well, it tells me that they are serious about dealing with a water issue. And, you know, going back to the reader, he or she, I can't remember if it was she or he, was asking the right question about development, right? I too laughed when I saw it, but it is about that. How much do we want to grow and at what expense? You know, in this case, we're talking about using agricultural water to build more homes. And so eventually we may not have an agriculture at all. And by when I say eventually, you know, I'm talking about, I don't know, 100 years from now. So that is concerning as well, because Arizona is one of the agriculture states in the nation. You know, Joanna writes a lot about, we are the only state that grows lettuce in the winter, for instance, you know, and that kind of a thing. So we're talking about the Harquahala Basin, one basin, but then it could expand to others. So that's something that it concerns me about. You know, another thing that I always have questions about is this deal. It sounds great on paper, but it will take a lot of money to actually do it. You know, they have to build the infrastructure. They have to build the pipelines to bring the water into the urban areas. And I just hope that we, the taxpayers, are not hooked for that bill in the future. So the deal sounds great, but what is that going to do to our agriculture? Mm-hmm. And whether that opens up to less agriculture, more development, and then it's a vicious cycle.
Right. Let me ask you about that, Joanna, because Elvia brings up an important point here, which is that if the future of the state relies on basically getting rid of agriculture because it uses too much water and using that water instead to develop and continue growing, what does that say about the future of the agricultural industry in our state? Like, don't we need that?
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, if that is the goal, if that is what the MO is to get rid of agriculture in Arizona, I think we're kind of misplaced. Mm. You know, agriculture does have a place here. The question is how much and how do we continue to help farmers be successful at the same time, understanding that we have these water realities. I think what's interesting about the ag to urban bill is that the people that are going to be selling their land, this isn't going to be a mandated kind of thing. It's going to be a farmer who decides, you know, hey, I'm at retirement age, or honestly, a lot of the places that own land out there are developers that bought that land many, many years ago to develop and then just leased it to farmers mm-hmm. who are going to say, you know what, it's in our best interest to try to get some additional value out of our land. And that they'll be replenishing that water too. It's not like with agriculture, there is some replenishment that happens just with the amount of water that they're using in irrigation, but largely a lot of that is not being replenished. Housing does replenish that water. So, I mean, it's choices, right? It's trade-offs. It's trying to figure out how do we balance all of these very different but very valid uses of water to move forward.
Elvia, let me ask you about that. You also have the argument that we can't stop developing. We can't stop people moving here. Like, actually, you just can't stop doing that. But also, if we do, there would be economic implications, right?
There are economic implications for everything. And yes, we can't stop people from moving here. I mean, if there are no places to live, you know, that choice will be theirs, right? Where are they going to rent? Where are they going to buy a house? Agriculture and, you know, vegetables and what have you are very difficult to grow here. And we're not growing enough of that. In the United States, we're importing most of that. This will exacerbate the problem instead of helping.
So let me ask you lastly, Joanna, about how you think those puzzle pieces should be balanced, I guess, in the future. What you're looking at here is taking water from one place and giving it to another so we can develop agricultural interests versus urban interests. Do you think that this will be an ongoing shuffle as we continue forward?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is going to be something that we will continue to wrestle with for decades. And, you know, the thing that I continue to say, and I'll probably say it until I'm blue in the face, is that, you know, nothing that we do moving forward is going to be perfect. There's no perfect water deals because there's not enough water to go around in the way that we used to use water. Hmm. And so we're going to have to think in new ways. We're going to have to do things. And so I say all the time, don't wait out for the deal that is the deal that you want. Take the deal that you can live with, because that's kind of the way that we move forward. And so it's going to take those kinds of compromises between farmers and cities and, you know, data centers and giant semiconductor factories and all of the different water uses that we have and that are emerging in our state. They all are going to have to make sacrifices and compromises to sort of have a rising tide lift all ships.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is Joanna Allhands, columnist for the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz. Thank you both. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
You bet.
Closing arguments are expected to get underway later this week in Hong Kong in the national security trial of democracy activist Jimmy Lai. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, let's start off with a reminder of who exactly Jimmy Lai is.
Well, Jimmy Lai is a 77-year-old entrepreneur turned democracy activist. He founded the Giordano fashion brand, but in his later years set up a publishing business and created the newspaper Apple Daily, which has been vociferously critical of Beijing. He's a proper rags to riches tale after he arrived in Hong Kong from China aged 12 as a stowaway on a fishing boat, his formerly wealthy Chinese family having lost everything when the communists took power in 1949. He then worked odd jobs and did knitting in a small clothing shop, teaching himself English. He went from a sort of fairly menial role to eventually founding a multi-million dollar empire. The Giordano chain was a huge success, but when China sent tanks in to crush pro-democracy protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square in 1989, Mr. Lai began a new journey as a vocal democracy activist. Now, he was jailed previously on fraud charges and for his involvement in protests in the territory, but the charges he's currently being tried for could mean he spends the rest of his life behind bars.
Yeah, so what exactly is Jimmy Lai currently being tried for?
He stands accused of treason under Hong Kong's controversial national security law amid allegations of colluding with foreign forces. The trial's been going on for quite some time, and Jimmy Lai first took the stand in his defense back in November of last year. He said he had never used his foreign contacts, which include the ex-US Vice President Mike Pence and former Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen, to influence foreign policy on Hong Kong. He was also asked about a meeting with the then US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, to which he said he had asked Pompeo, quote, not to do something, but to say something, to voice support for Hong Kong. The trial has drawn international attention, with even Donald Trump saying previously that he would, quote, 100% get Jimmy Lai out of jail. Now, Jimmy Lai's lawyers argued back at the start that their client could not expect a fair trial in today's Hong Kong. A barrister on his international team, who was not able to represent his client, Jonathan Price, said, you still have the apparent institutions in place, you have the buildings and the judges, and you have lawyers. But in fact, the fundamental principle of the rule of law is eroded. A final verdict in the case is expected later in the year.
All right. So, Jonathan, let's go now from Asia to South America, where on Sunday, voters in Bolivia will be going to the polls. What's the backdrop to this election?
Well, Bolivia has been in the grip of fairly serious political turmoil and an economic crisis. The ruling Movement for Socialism, or MAS, has dominated Bolivian politics for nearly two decades since the election of Evo Morales back in 2006, but it's currently fractured after the incumbent president, Luis Arce, was elected in 2020. Evo Morales had been ousted amid protests over alleged election fraud in his election the year before, and he went into exile, returning after the election of his successor, who's from the same party. But the two haven't really seen eye to eye since. Evo Morales accused the government of trying to assassinate him, and there was a power struggle over who should be this year's presidential election candidate. In the end, Morales was ruled out over presidential term limits, and Arce ruled himself out of the running amid his declining popularity. That's because Bolivia's economy has been reeling, with inflation at around 25%, fuel shortages, and dwindling dollar reserves sparking public discontent. Now, Bolivia has huge lithium reserves, which are critical for global technology supply chains, and in particular the switch to electric vehicles around the world, and that's left some foreign powers seeking influence over the next government.
Well, who is in the running then to be Bolivia's next president?
Well, with Morales and Arce both out of the race, the field is fairly open. No candidate is polling above 25%. In the lead, though, is Samuel Doria Medina, a centrist businessman and former minister of planning, who's currently polling with around 25% support. Then there's Jorge Quiroga, a former industrial engineer who actually served as president of Bolivia from 2001 to 2002. He was a candidate for president in both the 2005 and 2014 election, and his support currently stands at around 23%. Both the front runners are seen as fairly right-wing options. The current ruling MAS party candidate is Eduardo del Castillo, but his support is way behind the two candidates I was just describing. The main left-wing candidate is Andronico Rodriguez, who's the current Bolivian Senate president. He's polling at around 7% support, but even he has said, alongside the front runners, that Bolivia needs a period of austerity to turn around the country's finances. Now, if no candidate achieves at least 50% of the vote, or wins 40% support with a clear lead of 10 percentage points over their nearest rival, the election will go to a runoff with the two leading candidates in October.
Interesting. All right, Jonathan, finally, Beijing will be playing host to the inaugural humanoid robot games later this week. What is that all about?
Well, we've all seen the videos of those human-like robots that are increasingly able to perform athletic and acrobatic tasks. But this event, which runs alongside China's World Robot Conference, which is already underway, aims to demonstrate these robots' abilities in a series of competitive games and demonstrations. They're taking place at Beijing's iconic National Stadium, which you'll remember from the 2008 Olympics, resembles a giant bird's nest, as well as the National Speed Skating Oval. There are 26 events in three categories: athletic competitions, performance showcases, and scenario-based challenges. The athletic events are sort of modeled on human sports, including track and field events such as the 100-meter sprint, a 4x100-meter relay, as well as long jump and football matches in a range of formats. The performance showcases involve solo and group robot dances, aiming to highlight things like artistic choreography. And then that third scenario-based category will involve challenges involving robots simulating real-world tasks like medical drug sorting, as well as logistics, in a manner sort of highlighting robots' practical applications. It's thought that around 100 teams from 20 different countries are planning to participate in the games.
And who are the global leaders when it comes to these sorts of humanoid robots?
Well, there are a range of big players. Boston Dynamics is pretty famous for its robots that demonstrate parkour moves, showing a high degree of balance and agility. Its Atlas robot is being trialed for manufacturing in Hyundai's car plants. Bigger is another humanoid robot from the US, which has been performing some tasks in BMW factories. The company has a valuation in the tens of billions of dollars. Elon Musk also seeks to dominate the sector. He believes Tesla's Optimus robot will transform labor-intensive and repetitive tasks, and he's targeting a price point for his machines below $20,000. But China, as indicated by hosting this Robot Games event later this week, is also a key player in the sector. Back in January, the Chinese firm Ubitech announced that its humanoid robots would start helping to assemble iPhones in Foxconn factories. So there's quite a lot of hype in this sector, and while skeptics think much of that is overblown, it will certainly be interesting to see to what extent the Robot Games alters perception of what these humanoid robots can do.
Absolutely. It'll be interesting to see who makes the podium during these humanoid robot games. All right. That is Jonathan Frewen with the BBC in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you too. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. If you're driving around and you see a car with a Trump bumper sticker, you'd probably figure the person driving it voted for the president. Similarly, if you had neighbors with Harris Waltz signs in their front yard last fall, you'd likely assume they marked their ballots for the former vice president. But a new study from the University of Arizona challenges those assumptions. Researchers looked at the correlation between people who buy political merchandise and people who end up voting for the candidates whose merchandise they buy. And the story is more complicated than you might think. Anastasia Ghosh is a co-author of the study, and she spoke with our co-host, Sam Dingman.
I have seen personally a lot more of, you know, my friends and my family members who started purchasing merchandise. So I kind of started paying also attention about how many campaigns have actively started to advertise political merchandise. And how popular some items have become and like literally sold out. So to me, it was a very interesting topic of where my work intersects, which is marketing, right? And politics, which is more of a hobby for me, where those two things come together and sort of the line between consumerism and politics kind of becoming smaller and smaller.
And do you feel like, you know, as somebody who studies marketing professionally and has a hobby in politics, as you put it, do you feel like there is some sort of tipping point that you have noticed where political merchandising became more mainstream? I mean, I know a lot has been made of the red MAGA hat. Do you attribute it to that, or do you think it started before then?
I mean, I think it's always existed, right? I don't think it never existed this magnitude. I would go back to 2008 election, right? All the merchandise, the Hope shirts, right? With
yes.
Barack Obama, where it moved from just being, you know, kind of a fringe industry, if you will, really small, to something then became mainstream.
So tell us how you and your team conducted this study. What did you look at?
So we were interested with this phenomenon, right? Why do people choose to buy those items, right? Political merchandise items, as opposed to just simply making a donation to the candidate. Maybe the people who do a t-shirt, right, instead of donation, are better, you know, supporters. So we kind of actually started with the opposite prediction of what we found.
Right, right. Because what you found is people who buy those merchandise items, t-shirts, hats, mm-hmm. mugs, bumper stickers, are engaging in what the study calls political selectivism.
Well, what we were interested in looking is, you know, the small purchase, a small donation is, of course, important for campaigns. But mm-hmm. what really matters is when you, you know, volunteer for a campaign, when you pick up a call phone and call others, right? Show up at the rally, or ultimately the most important thing, right, is you show up to vote. So what we find is that people who made a donation to campaign in the form of merchandise, as opposed to just what we call a silent donation, were less likely then to engage in those more important candidate support activities, all the way up to being less likely to vote.
Right. And the number there was striking, right? It was, in particular, with the 2020 election, people who bought political merchandise were 91% less likely to vote.
Yes, compared to somebody who gave equivalent silent donation, right? So, of course, both groups of people, the one who buy merchandise or make donations, are more likely to vote in general than any random person who never was engaged in campaign at all, right?
Yep.
But if we're looking at supporters, the campaigns should really focus on those who make donations, silent donations, than those who get those mega hats.
Right. Well, so what does this suggest to you about the ways campaigns are spending their money?
I think merchandise has a place in, if you think about campaign as a long-term cycle, right? At the beginning, you're really interested in rallying your base and maybe attracting independents, and it's all about signaling. So at that time, even though you get less money out of selling merchandise, it's beneficial because the more people wear your t-shirt with your name, the more potentially exposure you get, right? But as campaigns draw to the close, what you're really interested in is those really heavy action items, volunteering, making calling on a day to make sure people show up in the polls and ultimately go and vote. So our recommendation is to actually, you can start with this, especially maybe if you're an underdog candidate, right? Not a lot of people know about you. But as you get closer to the vote, you really should be focusing on sort of silent donations and not merchandise.
But that's interesting. I mean, it's making me think back to the Obama example that you cited at the beginning of our conversation. And it hadn't occurred to me in that moment, but what was really remarkable about those Hope t-shirts and stickers, as I recall, is that they did not include Barack Obama's name. It was just the word Hope.
And I do have another working paper that we're working on where we kind of take even one step further and we look at what kind of candidates, what kind, supporters of what kind of candidate is more likely to buy merchandise. And we find that underdogs disproportionately attract merchandise purchases.
Oh, interesting. Because the other question here, I think, is if the folks who bought this merchandise were less likely to actually participate in the campaign or indeed vote, why were they doing it? like what did they get out of their purchase?
Yeah. So we believe that psychological process there, right, is that, and it's related to the idea of selectivism, is that people who bought merchandise felt like they did more for the candidate already. So they're less likely to follow up with other meaningful actions, right? And in some situations, that may be true. Like if I'm going to wear a t-shirt of my candidate and I live in a state that supports the opposite candidate, obviously it's a pretty big, you know, signaling from me, right? I'm doing a lot, right? We even had a nice experiment in the paper where everybody got a merchandise, but we manipulated whether they were observed by others or not. So they kind of walking through an empty store versus store filled with people. And only when store was filled with people, that's where we find the effect. That people felt like other observed me. I already done a lot for my candidate by signaling, you know, my affiliation, my support, and I don't need to do anything else.
This, if I'm not mistaken, is related to a phrase in the study that I was very interested in, which is impression management.
So impression management means how do other people see when I signal my identity, how do they perceive me, right? And it's pretty strong signal when I literally wear my identity on my sleeve in this case.
Yeah, there you go. What about, did you look at all at party affiliation amongst the folks that you
spoke
to?
Yeah, we did. We didn't find any difference.
Okay. So it's not like, you know, Democrats are more likely to buy t-shirts and not vote than Republicans are.
No. And if you think about most of our elections, right, these are the people the candidates are fighting for. They're not fighting for the strong support. They're finding people on the fringes who maybe I'll buy, you know, $20 t-shirt, but I'm not sure, right, how I feel about a candidate.
Right. The challenge for campaigns based on the findings in this study would seem to be, yes, try to excite that $15 or $20 donor enough to get them to buy some merchandise, but then how do you convert them into
an actual supporter? Yeah.
An actual supporter. Well, Anastasia Ghosh is a marketing professor at the University of Arizona and the co-author of this study. Professor Ghosh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.